You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, everyone. It's Takuya here.
And I'm Gabby.
And we are the hosts of History of Everything, a podcast which you can probably guess by the name is, well, I mean, it's about everything. Do you want to know why people thought potatoes were evil and would give you syphilis? Are you curious about all the stories of the terrible and stupid ways that people have kicked the bucket over the years? Do you want to hear tales about all of the different badasses of history and the lives that they had brought to life? Well, if so, then look no further. History of Everything is just the right podcast for you. It's available on Spotify, Pandora, and anywhere else that you get your podcast from. Join us for some fun and just see how weird and wacky history can be.
This episode is brought to you by our Patreon members. Thank you so much.
Join our Patreon for extra episodes, interviews, extra content, and to help support the podcast and help us continue to do the work we do.
Go to patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl to learn more.
Oh, it looks like there's all this crocodile talk in your grand gallery.
I'm Jenny Williamson.
And I'm Jen McMenemy.
And this is Ancient History Fangirl.
Okay, Jenny Williamson, it's time to talk pyramid to me.
As we talked about in our episode on the list, The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World, this list has changed throughout the centuries. The structures on the list change. They've been swapped out a number of times. It really depends on the century and on the list maker's agenda. We've discussed this, but there is one item on the list that is almost always on these lists. Almost always. Not always, but almost always. And when it's not, the list maker sometimes has to make it the honorary eighth wonder because leaving it out is so egregious. This is the oldest and largest of the seven wonders, the only one to survive into modern times, and it is the mother, the daddy, the true parental unit of all the wonders, the Great Pyramid of Giza.
And it's also the only one you can still see.
The only one to survive into modern times. It's almost like I already said that.
I'm just saying it again, because, like, you know, sometimes Janice just needs to be reminded.
It remains true. The Great Pyramid truly is a wonder. It's still potentially the largest structure just in terms of sheer, pure bulk ever built anywhere on the planet. Up until the medieval era, when it was briefly eclipsed by a cathedral which fell over after a few centuries and then not again until modern times, it was the tallest man-made structure anywhere in the world.
The Great Pyramid is an absolute masterpiece of human ingenuity, engineering, and sheer determination. It would be that even if it was built today. The fact that it was built in the ancient world with Bronze Age tools and technologies is even more incredible. The Great Pyramid rises from the Giza Plateau, a high limestone plateau that today rises over the modern city of Cairo. The Great Pyramid is part of a complex that includes two other, slightly smaller but still monumental pyramids, the pyramids of Khafre and Menkaure, along with smaller queen pyramids, causeways, temples, harbors, tombs, buried boats, necropoli, and workers' towns. Oh, and one very attractive sphinx.
It is one sexy, sexy sphinx.
Am I the only one who feels that way? Like, I don't know. There's just something about that sphinx where I'm like, you could eat crackers in bed.
Jen's like, the sphinx, wood bone.
No, because bestiality, we don't bone animals.
Its head is a human head. It can give consent.
Can it, though? I don't know. Anyway.
You know, it's smarter than a human, what with all the riddles.
No, wrong Sphinx. The Sphinx that gave the riddles was the Greek Sphinx, and that was a female.
The ladies are smarter. That is true.
That is true. Have you met my dog? Anyway. My dog couldn't figure out how to eat his dog treat. He came crying at me and was like, how do I work a Kong?
Hopefully the male Sphinx is not quite that tragic, one would hope. All we know about the Sphinx for sure is that it wants to be reburied because all its crevices are moist. That's what we know.
But all its crevices are also sandy. So anyway, I have thoughts. Moving on. The Great Pyramid was the first pyramid constructed here. It is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, structure on the plateau, dating from roughly the 2580s to the 2560s BC. Although the exact dates on this are fuzzy and still disputed. Most historians believe it took about 20 to 27 years to build. It was built by the pharaoh Khufu, also called Cheops in the Greek sources. And I just want to say 20 to 27 years for how massive that pyramid is and the tools they were working with is no time.
And we still don't know a lot about exactly how they did it. That's one of the big genuine mysteries around the pyramids.
This is going to be a two-parter. Like, we couldn't fit everything about the Great Pyramid of Giza into one episode. We are not capable of stopping talking about this pyramid.
I haven't done episodes on any of the others yet, but I think if any of the Great Wonders of the Ancient World deserves two episodes, it's the Pyramid of Giza. So I took the liberty of creating two episodes, and this is the first one. Okay, so shockingly little. We're talking about Khufu, who is the pharaoh responsible for the Great Pyramid. Shockingly little is known about Khufu's reign. We know that he sent expeditions into the desert in search of copper and turquoise. We know that he traded with the ancient city of Byblos in Lebanon. His name has been found inscribed on various buildings and statues, but the only statue of him that survives is only 3 inches high. And some historians think it was carved as many as 2,000 years after he died, although this is disputed. We don't actually know how old the statue is, but it's more of a figurine than a statue, really. It's itty bitty. We do know a little about Khufu's family. Speaking of problematic family relationships, Jen, some of the things we know are as follows. Historians believe that the previous pharaoh, Seneferu, might not have been Khufu's real dad. Maybe he was his stepdad. Khufu had 3 brothers and 1 sister who was married to one of his brothers. And he went on to have 9 sons and 5 daughters, several of whom married each other.
But there is one thing we can extrapolate just by looking at the pyramids. And that is, he must have had immense resources and tremendous unquestioned power over the populace in order to complete a construction project of this size. Did the weight of his head lie heavy? Hand. I was going to say can't be head. It's very weird. I was like, is he a Sphinx? Anyway, am I attracted to him because he's a Sphinx? Moving on.
Jen's like, of all the large statues in the ancient world, which one's fuck, marry, kill? Ancient statues edition. Where's Olympian Zeus in that?
Oh, boy. I can tell you it wouldn't be Mary.
No, that's not. Listen, Olympian Zeus is there for the. He's a fuck daddy.
Gonna marry Dionysus. Oh, no, my Sphinxy. I'm just gonna fuck him too. Give me some more.
Jen is like, I'm gonna fuck all the statues. It's a why choose.
It's a why choose. Why choose? They should all have me and I should all have them. We belong.
Oh my God, what is happening right now? This is the horniest episode about the Great Pyramid of Giza anyone's ever done. I think one thing that's very clear is that nobody wants to fuck the statue of Khufu. It's only 3 inches tall.
What am I going to do with that?
There's better options.
Jenny, look at me for a minute. Fucking red I am. I should say there has been wine.
Oh, you think? Anyway, what are we doing? I'm trying to just do this very serious episode about the Great Pyramid.
And it's turned into fuck, marry, kill, or just fuck them all. Anyway, why choose? So let's talk about what we don't know about Khufu. Did the weight of his hand lie heavy or light on his people? We don't know. We don't know if he was a good pharaoh or a cruel one, if his people loved him or loathed him. He probably wasn't an incompetent pharaoh just based on the Great Pyramid alone, but even that we don't know for sure. Ancient sources who came after made a lot of assumptions about Khufu. Herodotus, writing in the 500s BC, claimed that Khufu, quote, brought the people to utter misery. locking all the temples so no one could worship, and forcing his people to labor for 20 years to build the Great Pyramid. He also claimed that Khufu ran out of money to fund his pyramid building and prostituted out his own daughter to pay for it. She demanded that everyone who slept with her had to dedicate one stone to her, and there were so many stones because she boned so many people that they built the other pyramids with it. I mean, Herodotus, stop it. Let her live her life.
Nobody talks about that paragraph.
But we will.
Nobody talks about the part where Herodotus says this, because I read it and I was like, what the fuck am I reading? It reminded me of that other paragraph in Herodotus where he's talking about sacred prostitutes and about how the ladies have to stand outside the temple for years and years until somebody throws the money in their lap, and then they have to bone that man, and then nothing will get them to sleep with you no matter what, as long as they've done this boning ritual in the temple. I feel like Herodotus every so often has these sweaty, sweaty fantasies about women having sex in some kind of coerced fashion, and that is what I think this is.
It's real gross, and it's real, like, it's so misogynistic.
What is happening here? Right. Anyway, so Diodorus Siculus, writing between 60 and 40 BC, claims that even though Khufu and his brother Khafre, called Chephren in his account, built the pyramids to be their tombs, they had to have their bodies interred elsewhere because the people were so incensed at the many cruelties of these pharaohs, including the horrible violence and misery of forced labor building the pyramids, that they threatened to drag the pharaoh's corpses out of their tombs and rip them limb from limb. I mean, to be fair, in Diodorus's time, which was roughly around Julius Caesar's time, the Alexandrians had quite a reputation for ripping their own pharaohs limb from limb. But in that time, the Alexandrians were ruled over by Macedonian Greek colonizers, the Ptolemies, and the relationship between them was very tense. We have no reason to assume that the Alexandrian people were just as ready to rip a pharaoh's limbs off when that pharaoh in question was one of their own. We don't know that that is the case. Plus, he was writing roughly 2,500 years after the fact.
It's conjecture.
It possibly might be entirely made up.
Hot. And while there are many mysteries about the pyramids, the one thing that isn't mysterious is the status and lives of the people who built them. But we'll get there.
Yeah. So the Great Pyramid is so enormous a topic that it can be tough to know where to start. So let's start with the first area, territory, perhaps, you'll encounter when you visit it, the outside. We're going to start on the outside and work our way in. Imagine you're standing at the foot of the Great Pyramid and looking up. As I've said before, this is truly a monumental structure. Hard to imagine if you haven't been there. Its base is a square with a footprint of 755.75 square feet, and its original height was 481 feet tall. It's currently about 449 feet tall. That makes it taller than the Statue of Liberty, the Big Ben Tower, and the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Today, you are not allowed to climb all the way up to the very tippy top of the Great Pyramid. The punishment is a multi-million dollar fine and jail time. Which makes me sad because I love to be on top of things.
No, don't say it that way.
I love to be on top of things, Jen. I just want to get on top of that Great Pyramid.
All right, so are you fuck, marry, and killing, like, the Sphinx, the Great Pyramid, and the tiny statue of Khufu?
Okay, so I do not want to fuck anything on the Giza Plateau.
That's not what you just said.
I just want to be on top of it platonically, in a platonic fashion. I do. It's true. I want to climb on top of all the things, and I want to be all up in the nooks and the crannies in a completely non-sexual fashion. I don't see why it always has to be sexual.
Have you listened to our podcast?
I realize the more I say that, the more it sounds like I want to bone them, but I'm
gonna... You think?
What's wrong with this podcast?
I don't know. It's so off the rails today.
Something so deeply wrong with us. I do follow the rules, though. But so this is our imagination. We can do whatever the fuck we want. We are visiting the monuments in our minds, just like Philo encouraged us to do in his original list of seven wonders when he said that if we tried to see them all with our actual eyeballs, we would all die. So just imagine it, you guys. So we're following his advice. And that means that we can basically climb on top of whatever we want, but we're going to keep it PG. There'll be no illicit groping of the pyramid. None.
Fingers crossed. So.
Okay, so the first thing we're going to do, because this would be the first thing that I did if I was allowed to, which I'm not, is climb all the way to the top. I'm so excited. I cannot wait to do this. Let's do it.
Could you imagine like looking out from the top of the Great Pyramid just across the vast desert and the Nile you might be able to see from that top? I mean, it would be incredible. Just like the whole city laid out there. Oh, it would be amazing.
See, you want to do it too.
Of course I do. I didn't say I didn't want to climb to the top. I was just not about like getting in the nooks and crannies and sitting on it in a weird way.
Oh man, you're gonna enjoy the nooks and crannies. I'm gonna make you love it. You're gonna love the nooks and all the crannies.
We'll see.
We're not gonna grope the pyramid. We're gonna keep our hands to ourselves, mostly. You guys, I'm really sorry. I'm really embarrassed. I'm embarrassed about this episode. I put so much work into it, and Jen made it dirty.
I didn't. I was just commented that I thought the face of the Sphinx was attractive, and here we are.
Jen had to make it known. Her illicit lust for the Sphinx.
Whatever, I regret it. I regret it. I take it back.
Me too. I regret everything. Moving on.
Everything. Moving on.
We're climbing to the top of the Great Pyramid in a completely non-sexual fashion.
I hate that we have to say that. The Great Pyramid was built using 2.3 million blocks of limestone, each weighing an average of 2.5 tons. The whole thing weighs around 5.75 million tons. From a distance, the pyramid looks like it would be easy to climb. The blocks form a staircase all the way to the top. But up close, you realize that each of those blocks is about chest height, and you'll have to pull yourself up each one. It's a strenuous climb, although it doesn't require any special gear. You just need a certain amount of endurance and upper body strength and permission. So, as you climb, you may notice that the pyramid is a tad roughly constructed. Apparently, as much of a wonder as the Great Pyramid is, Khufu didn't mind cutting a few corners to get the thing done. I mean, makes sense. 20 to 27 years is a short time for how big it is. The blocks are roughly dressed and of irregular sizes. There are sand-filled cavities in the construction, so the workers weren't trying to get the blocks to fit perfectly. Gaps in the stone were filled with chips and mortar. As you climb, you may knock down pieces of stone or showers of sand. And that's one of the reasons you're not allowed to climb it today.
You wouldn't have been able to do this in Khufu's time. Originally, the pyramids were encased in smooth white limestone mined from Tura, which is a quarry that I believe is just like maybe 15 miles up the Nile River. I had a little bit of a hard time figuring out exactly where it was, but it's not that far away. Anyway, this was very high quality limestone, polished to a fine sheen. You wouldn't have been able to see the stair steps or the flaws in the outside because all of that was covered up, hidden from view. The pyramid would have been perfect and smooth from the outside. You can still see a little of that today. There is a little bit of that ancient Tura limestone, I believe, just around the base. And some of the original Tura limestone facing remains at the very top of the pyramid. So if you do manage to scale the last little expanse of smooth Tura limestone, when you get to the very tippity top, you'll find a flat platform with a stunning view of the surrounding Giza Plateau, the other pyramids, the city of Cairo, beyond the sparkling Nile. It would be absolutely epic and unforgettable. You will not get this view anywhere else. I'm not saying that you should do it. I'm just saying you should imagine it. There used to be a pointed pyramidal capstone at the top called a pyramidion that may have been plated in electrum, which was a combination of gold and silver. While the Great Pyramid's pyramidion is lost, we know from other pyramidions that have been found that it probably would have been covered in hieroglyphs and religious imagery, so it would have been absolutely stunning.
It should be noted that as glorious as it sounds, climbing the Great Pyramid is not only both strenuous and illegal, and could get you fined into poverty and jailed, but it's also deadly. The most dangerous part is allegedly the climb down, where you have to hop down hundreds of chest-height steps. The pyramidal blocks are, from what we hear, slippery, worn down from millennia of traffic and weather and time. One misstep could send you tumbling hundreds of feet, bouncing off sharp stone blocks to land at the bottom, a pummeled wreck. Well, that doesn't sound fun, Jenny.
Sounds like a real bummer.
Multiple people have died trying to climb the Great Pyramid. Over the past 200 years, approximately 1,600 people have fallen to their deaths trying to climb it. Although the numbers on this are fuzzy. The Egyptian government doesn't currently publicize records on this, presumably because it's bad for tourism and also because they don't want people to get any ideas. Can't blame them.
In the 1800s, a British tourist named John Mays took his own life by jumping off the top of the Great Pyramid. According to the American Penny Magazine, in an article published in 1845, a friend who was waiting at the bottom, quote, saw Mays lying on the sixth step from the top, evidently in extreme agony. But before he could reach him, the unfortunate man uttered a groan, and rolling heavily down from step to step, the body continued to descend with accelerated force until it reached the bottom, a mass of bleeding matter. So it is, like, really bad to jump or fall off of the pyramid. It is not a good death. In 1980, a college student was killed climbing down the Great Pyramid. That was not a suicide. As far as I know, it was an accident. In 1989, another British tourist died after climbing the pyramid and falling asleep at the top and then rolling off the pyramid to his death.
Sounds like how I'm going to go. I'm going to be so tired when I get up there and be like, I'll take a little nap. Boom.
So it's been illegal since the 1950s to climb the Great Pyramid, but the law didn't really start being enforced until the 80s when deaths like these became more widely publicized. Jenny and Jen here to tell you about our new favorite novel, Orphea and Eurydiceus by Elise John.
Pip Williams, author of The Dictionary of Lost Words, says, quote, as I read Orphea and Eurydiceus, I imagined the muses beside Elise John, focusing her mind and guiding her hand. The writing is poetic and evocative, and this story will thrill readers who have long suspected something is missing from the classics of Greek myth.
Laura Shepperson, author of Phaedra, says, quote, bold yet beautiful, I was glued to the page, compelled by the story of Lady Orphea and her love, the gentle shieldmaker Eurydiceus. Orphea and Eurydiceus is a thoughtful consideration as to what it means to be a man, a woman, a hero, a human being. I love this retelling and couldn't stop thinking about it. Lady Orphea has my heart.
Andrea Stewart, author of The Bone Shard Daughter, says, quote, spins a bewitching tale of courage, love, and defiance, giving voice and agency to the women in Greek tales who are so often defined by the men they are associated with.
Orphea and Eurydiceus is a luminous ode to women's voices, grief, and unconventional love for fans of Natalie Haynes, Jennifer Saint, and Madeline Miller. You can purchase Orphea and Eurydiceus on Amazon, the HarperCollins website, or anywhere books are sold.
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Brenna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore all of the weird little questions and conspiracies of the universe in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything. Everything has an explanation.
We hope.
But that is what we're here to figure out. We will dive into the science behind many popular conspiracy theories, such as vaccines causing autism, flat earth theory, and was the moon landing fake? And if so, why the heck would anyone even do that?
But it's not just conspiracies. There's a lot of cool mysteries that we will attempt to use science to explain, such as near-death experiences, what made the Vikings go berserk, and can I control my co-host with MK Ultra?
Wait, what? Anyway, make sure to check out the Mystery of Everything podcast everywhere where you find your podcasts.
Let's move away from the topic of unfortunate tourist deaths and onto the sheer glory of what the Great Pyramid of Giza must have looked like in ancient times, because it must have been absolutely jaw-dropping. Imagine approaching the pyramids of Giza and seeing not the mountainous stair-step sandstone monuments we see today, but huge, flawless white pyramids, rising from the desert, reflecting the light of the sun, each with a bright, glowing, silvery gold tip that blinded the eyes on a clear day. We'd all have to avert our eyes from the terrible glory of these monuments and the sexy, sexy Sphinx.
So sexy. Although, some ancient sources suggest something a little different. If you remember from our episode about the Seven Wonders, Philo of Byzantium, he goes a little weird describing the pyramid, and I'm going to just read this to you. Even though we quoted it in the last episode, I just want to remind you. This is how he describes the Great Pyramid, and I have a feeling he hadn't been there. Quote, The whole polished work is joined together so seamlessly that it seems to be made out of one continuous rock. So that makes it seem like the Tura limestone was still in place during his time, which I believe was around 200 BC. But in fact, different colors and types of stone have been used in its construction. Here there is white marble. Here there is black African stone. Then there is also what is called the blood red stone, and a stone of variegated translucent green brought, so they say, from Arabia. The colors of some of the stones are a dark glass green. Others are almost quince yellow, while yet others have a color that is likened to the purple in conch shells. To one's astonishment is added pleasure. To one's admiration, respect, and to its lavishness, splendor. I mean, what do we make of that description, Jen?
Having just done the research on the Olympian Zeus, I feel like it's the same, right? Like, you get these descriptions and you're like, I don't really understand what this looked like. You know, it might have been like all these great colors all over, but also it wasn't. Like, I don't know. It's really difficult. It kind of sounds like they got different stones from all over the place. And maybe they did and then coated it in something else. I don't know.
Much of the Tura limestone facings were stripped at various points in history to help build things in Cairo, I think, like in the medieval era, potentially earlier than that.
That happened across many, many ancient monuments, including the Temple of Olympian Zeus and other places.
Hadrian's Wall, you know, it's a very common occurrence. Is it that it wasn't just Tura limestone, it was other stone too? I've never seen any historian give credence to that idea or suggest that that's the case. I think we pretty much know where all the limestone came from. The simplest explanation is potentially that Philo had just never actually seen the pyramid, so he was just kind of going a little wild in his imagination. But if anybody knows anything else about this, please DM us or something, because I'm very curious.
It's interesting what Philo gets right. He gets the height and circumference about right. He says that, quote, the whole polished work is joined together so seamlessly that it seems to be made out of one continuous rock. And that suggests that the Tura limestone casing was still there when he wrote about it. However, his description of the multicolored stone is probably not correct, as Tura limestone is known for its white or light cream color. How much we can trust Philo's description is, as we've mentioned, a little questionable.
Yeah, I have absolutely no idea where he's getting this description of various colored stone. I thought I would maybe know a little bit more about it when I started this episode, but I do not, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's one of those things I think we're going to find a lot with these ancient monuments, where because they don't exist anymore, with the exception of the pyramid, we don't know what they were made of. So we have only ancient sources who may or may not have seen these things when they were there or at different points of them being constructed or being stripped for parts or anything else.
Everything except for the Great Pyramid, we're only relying on ancient sources, descriptions, and potentially things like images on coins and stuff like that.
Or Christian like mosaics and things like that in the image of Zeus, which is wild. Anyway, so let's go back to our imaginations. We've climbed intrepidly all the way to the top of the Great Pyramid, and we did not fall asleep at the top, even though I tried to. Jenny shook me awake and didn't let me fall. We stopped up there to enjoy the view, and then we climbed very carefully back down without injuring ourselves. Now, we stand once again at the base of the Great Pyramid.
Only in our imaginations would we be that capable.
Exactly. In my real life, I have fallen off, or I still live there because I won't go down.
She's still up there.
Still up there. Very sunburned.
They've arrested her, but they can't get to her because she won't come down.
They have to get a helicopter for me. It's fine. I won't climb down.
Like, no.
I know I'm not going to make it. That's why I won't climb down. Anyway, so it is now time to go inside the pyramid. We're going to go, we are going to get all up in the pyramid's nooks and crannies. And Jenny wrote that sentence. Clearly, I did not.
In a totally platonic fashion, let me reiterate. So let's walk around the base of the pyramid to the entrance, shall we? It'll be a bit of a walk as we descended on the south side and the entrance is to the north. So as we approach, we see that there are two ways into the Great Pyramid. The first is what is probably its original entrance, found on the north side and just 25 feet east of center. This entrance is topped by a two-layered, corbelled, triangular gable called a saddle vault that was probably there to support the massive weight of the stones above it. This is the oldest known example of this type of gable. And this is a large entrance. It's like the height of several people tall, let's say. It's pretty big. But it was originally covered by layers of stone and the limestone casing, so it would have been invisible when the pyramid was new. As we draw even closer, we see that this gabled entrance is in fact blocked. It is blocked. What? What? You mean we can't go inside of there?
What?
No!
Jenny, how will you get in those crannies?
How will I get into the crannies? But wait. Wait, Jen.
Oh, she's got a plan. Hold tight, everyone.
We scan the northern side, because obviously this cannot be the end of our journey. And we see an irregular hole in the stone, just below the original entrance and slightly to the right. It's just about high enough for a person to stand up in. This is the robber's tunnel. This entrance was hacked straight through the very living rock of the pyramid. And we don't know exactly who cut this tunnel or when. There's a story that places the blame on Caliph al-Mamun, an important ruler in the Abbasid Caliphate around 820 AD, but that is heavily debated today, and it's probably apocryphal. Some believe that this tunnel was dug by tomb robbers probably shortly after the pyramid was constructed, possibly by the very people who constructed it.
See, that would be what I would do. I'd be like, oh, you're making me build it? I'm building a backdoor in to steal your shit.
One theory, and there is a reason why people think that, although there's also an alternative theory that says it must have been at least a few hundred years afterwards, or maybe a few decades afterwards, and I kind of want to do a whole episode on how to rob a pyramid, where we discuss all of these theories. I go a little bit into it in the next paragraph, but I obviously do not do this justice. If I do it justice, it will be on the Patreon. Okay, so one of the reasons why historians think that whoever dug this tunnel potentially either was or were the people who constructed it, or it was shortly after it was constructed to the point where this knowledge was still around, that they knew what they were doing, basically, is that the tunnel digs straight through the limestone unerringly for about 89 feet before turning left and meeting up with the original passageway, which slopes down from the entrance. And there are no missteps or false tunnelings. It's like the tunnelers knew exactly where they were digging in order to find the original passage, which at certain points would not have been visible through the outer layers of the pyramid at all. So how did they know that was there, right?
Exactly, unless their family built it, or they built it, and they were like, I've come back for what's mine, all the plunder.
The other thing is that in these pyramids, there usually was an entrance around the same place in all the pyramids, which was on the north-facing slope. So if this was soon enough after the pyramids were built, potentially that knowledge would still have been around, even if it wasn't the exact people who built it. But potentially it was the exact people who built it because they knew exactly how far to dig before to swerve left. There's no false tunnelings in there. They knew where they were going.
So, we've entered the pyramid through the only way we can today, the robber's way, the plunderer's way, the way that I'm super fascinated by.
That's the way tourists get into the pyramid now.
So, we've passed through this narrow, rather irregular, and yet more or less tall enough to stand up in tunnel.
At least according to the videos I've seen, I have not been in this tunnel.
Yeah. And now we veer slightly left at the end and pass up a modern stairway to get to the original passage. From there, there are two paths that can be taken, the descending passage, leading down deeper into the pyramid, or up the ascending passage, which leads to the queen's and king's chamber.
Let's go down first.
Okay.
That sounds a little sexy.
It did. I wasn't going to say anything. I was like, I'll let her dig that own little...
You know what? Okay, let's go into the descending passage. Let's go spelunking, okay? I'm not making it weird, not at all.
She's actively making it weirder. It's fine.
I just can't help it. It's like every time I open my mouth, it sounds weird. It's the descending passage. That's where we're going. We're going down.
You're going down on the pyramid. Yeah, I know.
Right, in the direction, purely directional fashion. My God. We're two middle-aged women who cannot stop joking about fucking the pyramid. Can we move on? So, the descending passage.
The back passage?
The back passage, that's right. It's usually blocked off to tourists. They don't want you getting up in there. They do not. But you know what? We're going to go in there anyway. That's what we're doing because it's our minds. It's our imaginations. We can do whatever we want in our imagination. It is a narrow squeeze. It's only roughly 3.9 feet high and 3.4 feet wide, which is pretty narrow if you think about it. It slants at a very steep angle. It goes 328 feet down into the bedrock beneath the pyramid. You will have to crouch most of the way unless you're extremely short. When you get to the bottom,
You maybe feel a slight breeze on your face, or maybe not. I don't know. I might be embellishing a bit. Look up. There's a hole in the west wall, just above the door to the subterranean chamber, which is a shaft that leads all the way up to the Grand Gallery, far, far above. We will be getting into this one too, but not now. So, we enter the subterranean chamber. This is the room at the bottom of the descending tunnel, which is dug 89 feet below the surface of the limestone bedrock of the plateau beneath the pyramid. It is irregularly shaped and probably wasn't finished. Some historians think that it might have been the original planned tomb for Khufu, abandoned for unknown reasons. And here, you can finally stand up straight. The ceiling is about 13 feet high, and the whole room measures about 27 by 46 feet. It's irregularly shaped, with recesses in the walls and trenches dug in the floors and just kind of weird nooks and crannies and shit.
Opposite the entrance, a corridor opens in the wall that runs roughly south for about 54 feet, curving at the end. We don't know if this corridor was original to the pyramid or dug by tomb robbers, but ancient Greek or Roman graffiti has been found on the ceiling of the corridor, suggesting that it was at least that old and that it was possible to get into the pyramid in those times, possibly through the robber's tunnel. I don't understand how they don't know the difference between if it's ancient Greek or Roman graffiti, because those are two different languages.
Maybe it's just something that's incomplete or it's a little bit hard to tell what they're looking at. I can't say because I haven't seen anything that specifically says what the graffiti was. If Julius Caesar did leave graffiti in the Great Pyramid, this is what it is and this is where it would be.
Oh, totally. And I don't think it's an if.
Veni, vidi, vici. Except it would have been with a W, but I refuse to say Weni, Weedy, Weechi. It's just too weird.
It would say something like Venus the Unconquered Sun.
And all he did was carve a picture of Venus, who could also be Aphrodite, and that's why they don't know if it's Greek or Roman. I figured it out.
He was like, that's my password. It's me. Everyone will know it's JC. Couldn't leave the JC. It would have been an I anyway, but it's fine.
Julius Caesar, what do you think of that?
Oh, Miss Williamson, I will never tell if I defaced a priceless monument. But one does tend to leave one's mark wherever one goes, do they not?
I feel like every time I call you these days, you insist on dirty talking me. He insists on it.
Julius Caesar, stop reading smutty romances in the afterlife.
I have given him a few recommendations.
You need to stop giving him the Tessa Baileys. In the Emily Raths. It's done. You need to stop, girl.
Just wait till I turn him on Katie Robert. Just wait.
Oh, I don't want to be here for those days. Anyway, moving on. In the eastern region of the subterranean chamber is a pit that's about 6.6 feet wide and 50 feet deep. Originally, it's thought that it was only about 5 feet deep, and that part may be as old as the pyramids itself, although this isn't known for sure. In 1837, gentlemen scholars dug the pit deeper, looking for a room filled with water as described in Herodotus, because why not?
I will talk more about this theoretical room filled with water in the second episode. So we've now thoroughly explored the subterranean chamber. We've spelunked, we've looked at every single nook, every single cranny, every single weird niche. We've crawled all up in there. And now it's time to go back up. So let's do that, shall we? So we crouch walk back up the steeply pitched narrow passage, ducking so we don't hit our heads. We ascend. We ascend roughly 236 feet until we get to what is called the ascending passage, opening in the ceiling above us. Although it doesn't really open in the ceiling above us because it's blocked off with giant blocks. The ascending passage rises higher into roughly the center of the pyramid, and it's how you reach the other two rooms, the queen's chamber and the king's chamber. Originally, it was basically another large hole in the ceiling of the descending chamber, and when the pyramid was built, it was blocked off by three huge granite blocks which workers slid down from the Grand Gallery, which we will get to in a bit. Most of those blocks are still there. I think one of them is missing. I'm not sure. We reach the ascending passage these days via a short passage dug from the robber's tunnel, which was later equipped with stairs.
We've seen the ascending passage described anecdotally as long and cramped. It's a bit less than 5 feet wide and 5 feet tall.
I would hazard to guess that it is not as long nor as cramped as the descending passage, but most of the time tourists don't get to go in the descending passage, so they don't have much of a comparison.
So, this bit is less than 5 feet wide and 5 feet tall, and it's a hunched over scramble up a ramp that slants at a 45 degree angle. This goes on for 128.9 feet, very exact, until it levels out and you're faced with a crossroads. Go straight through a horizontal passage to the Queen's Chamber, or continue to climb up into the iconic Grand Gallery and into the King's Chamber. Let's save the Grand Gallery and take the horizontal passage. It's another narrow fit, about 3.8 feet high and 3.4 feet wide, and it penetrates the heart of the pyramid for about 127 feet. And you need to watch your step, because as you almost reach the chamber, there's a rather large step down, so the height of the passage increases to 5.5 feet. That's just an inch over Jenny's head and about 2 inches over mine.
Now we get to the Queen's Chamber, and here you can straighten up again. The Queen's Chamber is a room about 18 feet long by 17 feet wide, with a gabled ceiling 15 feet high. It is notably empty. There is no coffin in here at all, or any hieroglyphs decorating the walls. While the walls are made of fine Tura limestone, the floor seems strangely unfinished. There is no coffin here, as I said, and no sign that there ever was one. Historians don't believe a queen or anyone else was ever buried here. Some believe this room may once have housed a life-size statue of Khufu, in keeping with a funerary tradition where tombs came equipped with a special room called a serdab, where the deceased statue was housed. This theory is backed up by the niche in the eastern wall, which is about 15 feet high, roughly triangular in shape. This could have been where such a statue once stood. Originally, the niche was only about 3.4 feet deep, but there is now a passageway at the back of the niche that was lengthened and widened by looters.
There are also two small square holes in the walls on the north and south sides of this chamber that lead to air shafts. We don't know what these shafts were actually for, but one thing we're pretty sure they weren't for was ventilation. We'll get into those later.
We really will. It will be detailed.
This is Jenny. It will be so detailed. There'll be no nook, cranny, or stone left unturned.
I want to get all up in the nooks and all up in the crannies. Pele, Hawaiian goddess of volcanoes, fire, and rebirth.
Maeve, Celtic warrior queen and nemesis of heroes.
Kiyohime, Japanese fire-breathing snake demon.
Pesta, Norwegian spirit of the Black Death. Our book, Women of Myth, is a fascinating look at women and femme characters in world mythology, including goddesses, heroines, and monsters. With captivating illustrations by Ringo Award-nominated artist Sarah Richard, it's the perfect gift for the mythology lover in your life, including yourself.
Find Women of Myth wherever books are sold.
Okay, let's leave the Queen's Chamber and continue on our visit, shall we? We go crouching back through the horizontal chamber to where it meets the ascending chamber, and it's here that we have the chance to ascend again, because above our heads, a new passage opens up, the Grand Gallery, possibly the most spectacular part of the pyramid's interior. So far, all the passageways into the pyramid have been claustrophobic and cramped. Unless you're really short, you'd have to crouch to get through. But the Grand Gallery rises far above our heads, 28 feet high, and at the base, it's almost 7 feet wide. However, as it rises toward the ceiling, the passage closes in 7 large stone blocks that close slightly inward as they go up, so that the top is only about 3.4 feet wide. This is a corbelled roof, and you see it in other places too, such as the niche in the Queen's Chamber.
The Grand Gallery is a truly spectacular example of ancient masonry. If you happen to be an ancient masonry nerd, this is not to be missed. It slants upward as you climb, and that climb is made easier by the modern stairway installed here. On the walls, there are empty niches. We don't know what they're for. There's so many mysterious niches in the pyramid.
Hot.
Sexy. Before the modern stairway was installed, the floor of the Grand Gallery was just, it was a ramp flanked on either side by what are described as shallow shelves or steps. So it was like a slanted ramp with some steps, like shallow steps on either side. The ramp itself is recessed into the floor a bit, kind of like a gutter, like a few inches lower than the stairs. And then there are these niches on the walls. And there's a theory that the central ramp in the floor of the Grand Gallery was used as a kind of slide for the large blocks that block the ascending passage. The ramp, or gutter, is the same width as that passage, and historians have speculated that perhaps the slots on either side of the walls, those weird niches, held wooden beams or some kind of wooden frame that kept those blocks in place and basically helped them descend, or held them up until the workers wanted to slide them down, perhaps using some kind of a pulley system. Some have suggested there might even have been some kind of trolley to move the stones, and perhaps the stair steps on the sides were for workers to sort of help guide these large stones down in a controlled slide. That is the theory.
We continue our climb up the spectacular Grand Gallery until we reach the top, where the passageway flattens out into a small platform. From there, another narrow tunnel leads horizontally through to the final site we're here to see, the King's Chamber. Before we get to the King's Chamber, however, the passage widens out into an antechamber, a small room sheathed in granite, which originally held a series of massive granite blocks that were a last line of defense against looting. There are slots and grooves on the walls where historians believe there were once beams, which supported ropes that could be used to raise or lower the stones.
There are no granite blocks here today. At some point in history, we don't know when, someone broke up these stones. Before that, thieves figured out that the limestone blocks of the pyramid itself were in fact softer than the granite. So they dug a passage up and over the granite to get into the chamber beyond, digging straight through the softer limestone. We don't know when this happened. Perhaps shortly after the pyramid was built, that's one theory. Maybe it was even the same people who dug the robber's tunnel from the outside, but nobody knows for sure. Okay, so now we proceed to the topmost chamber, the crowning chamber, the pinnacle of the Great Pyramid.
Swoon.
Right. Try to control yourself.
I'm trying.
Every time I call Julius Caesar, it's like he has to make it weird and sexy now. I don't understand.
I don't know what you two do in the afterlife since you've been enfianced. It's just been weird.
I'm just trying to have a normal conversation with my fiancé.
I can't.
I know. Anyway, I'm just trying to talk about the pyramid here. And Jen and Julius Caesar are making it weird. You're just like him. You do it too.
I blame Julius Caesar.
God. It's probably his fault.
It
Most
is.
Things are his fault if you look back far enough. Anyway.
Yes.
So anyway, I'm trying to talk about the King's Chamber, the penthouse, shall we say.
That's where the billionaire lives. He's going to take care of my lifestyle, right? Right?
That's right. It's where the Duke lives.
Hi, all.
This is future Jenny.
And future Jen. And as you're about to hear in this episode, we're going to go pretty far off the rails. Wine was had. I'm red just thinking about what I've said. We have about a 10-minute block here where we get very raunchy and very silly. I believe I shout at one point in time, "Do me, Duke."
I'm not ashamed of my silly drunkenness, but drunk me was not thinking about the colonialist implications of yelling about how the Dukes live in the pyramid. I'm so sorry. This was about romance novels we were reading and just being drunk and letting off steam. Apologies.
Anyway, we just wanted to say that we thought you'd enjoy this silly tangent, and we just wanted to make sure that you understood our position here when in the future we listen back and we're like, this is really funny, but we should clarify this. So we hope you enjoy this. If this isn't your thing, maybe skip ahead 6 to 8 minutes.
Enjoy. Do me, Duke. It's intense. It's the title of half the romance novels with dukes in them. Anyhow.
I really want to write a romance now that's just called Doomy Duke.
Somebody probably already called their romance novel that. You have to Google it.
Fine. I'll call mine Doomy Duke.
Two.
Doomy Duke now.
Doomy Duke the Reckoning. What are we doing? Anyway.
This is what happens when I only eat one meal a day and just drink.
Doomy Duke the Reckoning.
There will be alligators or crocodiles. It's Egypt, crocodiles.
That's up in our vaginas because, you know,
Because birth control. Do me, Duke. Hang on. Let me get my birth control down there.
It turns out that the reckoning is just a very bad yeast infection.
Oh, my God. We have to stop.
Can we please move on? I'm just trying to describe.
I don't know. Please go.
Just trying to describe the penthouse. So, this is the penthouse.
Duke.
Stop it.
The reckoning.
Stop it. The badge inspector has arrived. Oh, it looks like there's all this crocodile talk in your grand gallery.
In your crevices. It's so moist.
They had to tunnel an alternate passage.
Oh, no, the back passage.
The material is so much softer.
Hang on, Jenny, just look for it. Look at me for a second.
Oh my God, it's quite the shade of red. Okay, so I'm going to talk about what's happening in the king's chamber. You're going to stop.
I'm going to be quiet.
It is the penthouse of the Great Pyramid. It is the king's chamber. It is entirely lined with granite, floor to ceiling, and it measures 34 by 17 feet, roughly. Its ceiling is 19 feet high, and it is flat. And that's because it is built of 9 megalithic stone slabs weighing about 400 tons total. Disconcertingly, if you look at that ceiling closely enough, shine your flashlight up there, there are in fact cracks in those roof stones due to the settling of the immense weight of the pyramid above it. Try not to freak out.
That would freak me out if I was in there.
It would wreck the mood just a tad. I would just want to maybe be on top so I'm not looking up. Not because I like to be on top of things in general, just so I'm not looking at the stones and contemplating my mortality.
If this episode proves anything, it's that you like to be on top. Now moving on.
Yes, we've discussed that thoroughly. Anyway.
Oh my God, why? Why?
What is the matter with us? We are serious, serious podcasters.
We're serious historians who do real research.
Are we serious historians like Herodotus was a serious historian?
Yes, you know what? I am as serious a historian as Herodotus or Pliny the Elder.
Herodotus has to keep making it dirty with all these like weird prostitution stories. So I think we're actually continuing in the vein of Herodotus.
Or even Pliny the Elder, who's like, I don't know, they just told me it was true, so I believe it. And I don't know about a woman's body. And I'm like, I bet you don't.
Listen, don't put something in your vag because you heard it on our podcast.
Anyway, moving on. As in the Queen's Chamber, there are 2 air shafts in the King's Chamber that slant up at a steep angle to reach the outside near the top of the pyramid. We'll get to those in a little bit. The vibe in this chamber is austere. The walls of the king's chamber are entirely uninscribed. There is nothing in this chamber except a sarcophagus made of a single granite block, unadorned and unpainted, painstakingly hollowed out. It was already broken open when this chamber was entered in the early Middle Ages. These days, it's missing a lid, and there is no sign of a mummy or any other funeral riches.
This absence of a mummy has led to a lot of speculation over the years. Some say that the room never contained a mummy in the first place. Pseudo-historians have come up with all kinds of wild theories, such as that the pyramids were actually interstellar devices built to communicate with aliens, or other alternative theories, such as they were built by mystical white people, i.e. Atlanteans, 10,000 years ago. That is a real theory that exists. People who buy into these theories are, of course, completely disregarding the vast evidence of looting over the centuries, much of which we have already discussed, which is a better explanation for why no treasures or mummies have been found here.
Another question that conspiracy theorists raise is, does this pyramid really belong to Khufu? And how do we know? One thing we noticed on our tour is that there are almost no hieroglyphics in the entire building. We don't see lavish decorations inside the tombs, as you might expect. Pharaohs were self-aggrandizing and loved to plaster their names on everything. But Khufu's name isn't anywhere on this pyramid. This leads to speculation that the pyramids are actually older than we think, maybe 10,000 years old, like the Sphinx, that's not true, and not associated with Khufu at all.
So first off, Egyptologists point out that not putting his name on the pyramid actually wasn't that unusual for Khufu's time. So during this period in the Old Kingdom, pharaohs, as I've read, typically didn't put their names all over everything or cover their tombs in elaborate hieroglyphs. The ancient Egyptian civilization lasted for about 3,000 years, I think, and traditions and customs changed during that time.
But also, we do have documentation from around the time the pyramid was built. A lot of it. There are inscriptions on temples, statues, and other structures from ancient Egypt post-pyramid building that mention Khufu as the builder of the Great Pyramid. And the oldest collection of papyri ever discovered in Egypt, in fact, talks about its construction in detail, and it has been dated to this time. In 2013, archaeologists found a collection of ancient texts in a cave at the ancient port of Wadi El Jarf, I may be pronouncing that wrong, on the shores of the Red Sea. Among these texts was a logbook from the 27th year of Khufu's reign, written by a mid-level supervisor named Merer, who was involved in the pyramid's construction. His actual job was to oversee the transportation of limestone blocks used for the pyramid's fine limestone casing from the mine at Tura to the pyramid worksite. And we will get into more detail about those in part two of this series about the pyramid. But basically, he talks about Khufu and this pyramid, and it's very clear who is the commanding pharaoh here.
And we do have hieroglyphics in the pyramid itself that name Khufu. They're not in the king's chamber, but they are very close by. As you stand in the king's chamber, look up. Past the nine disturbingly cracked megalithic rocks.
Don't think about it too hard. Just look beyond that. Use your x-ray vision. It's your imagination, okay?
Yeah, try not to think about the cracked rocks above the ceiling in this chamber. Past the nine disturbingly cracked megalithic rocks, above the ceiling of this chamber, there are five layers of flat megalithic stone, and between them, five open spaces called the relieving chambers. Gentlemen scholars who discovered the relieving chambers named them after their wealthy English aristocratic friends. They called them Davidson's Chamber, Wellington's Chamber, Nelson's Chamber, Lady Arbuthnot's Chamber, and Campbell's Chamber. Theoretically, these chambers are there to relieve the immense weight of the pyramid pressing down on the king's chamber. The topmost chamber has a pointed limestone roof to redirect weight to the sides. That's fascinating.
So when these chambers were discovered in the 1800s, they were festooned with graffiti written in red ochre paint in ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. These graffiti spell out the name of work gangs, and given their positioning on the stones, sometimes sideways or upside down, they seem to have been written before the stones were laid. They name Khufu extensively. It took decades to translate these inscriptions, but eventually they were translated. Turned out they were the names of work gangs, all with special names that included Khufu's name. The gang names were as follows.
Quote, the gang, the Horus Medidu, is the purifier of the two lands. Medidu is Khufu's Horus name.
I'm not sure what a Horus name is. I'm sure that information is out there.
I'm guessing it has to do with him being associated with the god Horus and maybe like the divine right to rule, but I could be wrong. I have no actual knowledge if that's true, and I've had a lot of wine.
Another of the graffiti says, the gang, the Horus Medidu is pure.
Hot.
Sexy.
The gang, Khufu, excites love, hotter.
Okay, that one's just on the nose.
That would be what I would call my gang name, right?
And the next one says Doomy Duke. That might be painted on there by Lady Arbuthnot, I'm not sure. No, for real. The next one says, the gang, the white crown of Khufu is powerful. So Khufu is Khufu's full birth name. Anyhow, so do we have extensive evidence that Khufu was the person who built the pyramid? Yes, including inscriptions in other places, like statues, tombs, and other buildings that talk about it.
The papyri, written by a foreman on the pyramid building site. It dates from the time of Khufu and names his half-brother as the chief overseer of the project. Stop with your conspiracy nonsense.
And the graffiti and otherwise inaccessible areas of the pyramids where Khufu is named extensively. Okay, so now that we've gotten it out of the way that yes, Graham Hancock, Khufu did indeed build the Great Pyramid. That is not a question.
Find a new hustle.
Find a new scam. We can get to my favorite part, which is exploring all the weird nooks and crannies, because it's not like we've not been doing this already. Look, no. All we've been doing so far is exploring, like, the parts that you can go. I want to explore the parts where you're not allowed to go. I mean, okay, so the descending chamber, you're not allowed to go. We have not been, in fact, getting up into the really weird nooks and crannies. We've been getting into, like, the ones that are firmly, for the most part, not all of them, firmly on the tourist track that you can actually go see. But I want to get into the parts that you cannot go see. All the weird nooks and the weird crannies that are weird.
There's territory in the Great Pyramid beyond what you get to see as a tourist, and some of these areas offer a lot of insight into the pyramid's history, but mostly they open up more questions than answers. And in the grand tradition of this podcast, I am going to get all right up in there. Let me tell you what. For instance, the air shafts. That is the first stop. So I've already mentioned four air shafts in the Great Pyramid, two in the Queen's Chamber and two in the King's Chamber.
So let's picture ourselves back in the Queen's Chamber. Look at the walls. You may notice two small square holes, just a few inches wide, facing each other on the north and south walls. In 1872, gentlemen scholars found a bronze hook, a piece of cedar wood, and a ball of diorite in one of them. These are the only objects ever found inside the Great Pyramid. We don't know what these items were for. Some have speculated they were tools used in the pyramid's construction. Interestingly, the cedar wood has been radiocarbon dated to 3,341 to 3,094 BC, so roughly 750 or 500 years or so older than the pyramid itself. Possibly, the tree it was cut from was around that old, or this item itself was a part of a treasured tool or artifact passed down for centuries before it was left in the pyramid air shaft. We don't know. That's so fascinating.
It would have to be like a really treasured tool or artifact to like exist and be used for 750 to 500 years, though. Like, they wear out sooner than that, you would think. I mean, I don't know what it was for, but so both air shaft passages run horizontally for about 6 feet before slanting upward at an angle of about 38 degrees, rising for about 240 feet before stopping about 20 feet short of the outside of the pyramid. So they never even reach the outside, which is why people think these are not air shafts. The southern shaft has a lot of weirdness in it. It was once blocked at the entrance by a wall block, so you couldn't even see it when you walked into the room. And it was also blocked high above by two slabs of limestone near the end. In 1993, a German engineer, Rudolf Gontenbrink, sent a robot up the shafts to see what was up there, because he was one of those, you know, people who needs to be up in all the nooks and crannies. I understand this urge.
Oh, girl, that was a potential husband.
I mean, at least he understands my urges to be up in the nooks and the crannies. He built robots for that purpose.
In 1993, that's your jam.
That's when all the problematic romance was published involving robots. Anyway, I was a troubled teen.
Good luck editing this episode.
I'm just going to edit out all the really excessively personal stuff and then it'll be 10 minutes long. So in the southern shaft, about 230 feet up in there, he found a polished limestone door blocking the passage with two pieces of eroded copper attachments that looked like handles. In 2002, the National Geographic Society sent another robot up because who else needs to be up in the nooks and the crannies? The National Geographic freaks, that's who.
Don't tell Julius Caesar or Cullen, but, you know, you and National Geographic.
Why do you keep marrying me off?
Just saying.
Julius Caesar to Cucullin to the National Geographic. Do you have issues with me being single? Like, what is this?
I do not. I apologize. Drunk Jen has been reading way too many romances about dukes and being married off.
Anyhow, so the National Geographic Society were absolute freaks because they sent another robot right up in there, and this one had a drill because they needed to see what was behind the slab. And guess what it was? Another stone slab was behind the first stone slab. So there were two stone slabs blocking this passage.
Or not blocking, but keeping it from caving in. That would be my thoughts. I'd be like, maybe we stop drilling. Maybe this is here to like keep the pyramid from falling.
Stop drilling. It's like you used English words, but I don't understand what they mean.
Yeah, I'm like the opposite of like an explorer. I'm like, maybe we leave it alone and just draw a nice picture of it and like try not to disturb it too much. That's me.
How are we going to know what to draw if we don't explore it, Jen?
Well, we draw it first very well before we explore. Anyway.
We just use our imaginations, okay?
This is why I'm the mythology girl and you're the archaeology girl, right? Like, I want to extrapolate and build all these worlds in, like, mythology terms. And you're like, get in those crannies.
Yes, get in the kitty. Look, if I could fit in the air shaft, I would go up in there myself.
I also know that, like, I'm the war elephant and you're the precision tool. So, like, for me, it's like, if I want to get in those crannies, I'm going to mess it up. Whereas you're like, well, just go slow and steady. I'm like, what is slow and steady? Why?
We'll send a small, very carefully engineered robot up there with a drill. That's what we'll do.
Or there's an elephant that wants to go up there.
Jen's like one of those gunpowder archaeologists from the 1800s. Terrible.
This is why I'd never be an archaeologist. I'd just be a mythographer. Like, I don't want to do that.
This is why we're using our imagination, because we do not want to disturb the monument. We want to imagine with our minds. Just like Philo of Byzantium has encouraged us to do.
Understand yourself. If you are a gunpowder archaeologist, don't be one.
Right. Refrain.
Refrain. Let someone who has precision do that, and you just look at what they find.
Can we move on? I want to find out what happens in this shaft.
So, in 2011, researchers used a fiber optic camera to further explore the southern shaft. They sent it through... I can't. Give me a second.
I'm so sorry. We are adults. You're doing great.
Okay. They sent it through the hole drilled in 2002.
That's what she said.
That is what she said. And found hieroglyphics written on the wall in red paint that read 121, which was the length of the shaft in cubits.
That's what she said.
How drunk are you, you dumbass?
Not even tipsy.
They checked out the copper handles, which seemed decorative. Weird, as they're in a spot nobody could see, but if you've ever, you know, done a landing strip, you know.
The best decorative touches are in the spot nobody can see. That's what the pyramid builder said.
Damn straight. You're piercing those nipples for someone.
Listen, I gild my nipples for a reason. I feel like this this slab in the shaft with the drill hole is like the gilded nipples of the pyramid.
Or like the pierced penis. But anyway.
It's the Prince Albert of the pyramid.
It's the Prince Albert, yes.
Who are you trying to impress there, buddy? Who's going to see that?
Oh, no, they're not trying to impress. They're trying to pleasure, and I'm here for that. Anyway. And they noticed that the inside of the door also seemed polished and finished. So this odd little space was meant to be seen? Or was it a spirit door, Jenny? Was it a spirit door?
It's like a little room, a little polished room with handles way up in the air shaft. That's what it is.
Do you want to explain what spirit doors are?
Yeah, so like a spirit door is like a little narrow, not really a door, but like a slot carved in the wall of many ancient Egyptian tombs, which theoretically the spirit comes and goes from. And I think this is from a different time than the pyramids. Like, I don't think that they had spirit doors, but you can see them in different tombs. And I'm not exactly sure when they date to, but I don't believe there's any spirit doors in the Great Pyramid.
Anyway, there are also two air shafts on the north and south walls of the King's Chamber. They both start out horizontally before angling up through the pyramid. These shafts are not blocked, and they actually do come out high in the pyramid slope near the top. We have no idea if the original Tora limestone casing covered these holes or not.
There are two main theories about what these air shafts actually were, and both have been debunked. The first is that they were for ventilation, and this is now believed not to be the case because the shafts in the Queen's Chamber were both blocked in many different ways. Were they keeping something in or out? Question. So the second theory is that these shafts pointed to specific stars or constellations that had religious meaning for the Egyptians, and this is now also not believed to be the case because the air shafts in both the King's and the Queen's Chambers do not travel straight up through the pyramid to point specifically at anything. They change angles, they curve in one direction or another. And if you see like diagrams of the interior of the pyramid, it looks like the air shafts travel up in the straight line, but they actually don't. Like sometimes they like kind of move around features or open spots in the pyramid. So they're not like, they don't specifically point straight up to anything. As we said before, the ones in the Queen's Chamber are in fact blocked. You can't see any stars from them, and no light from any astronomical events can get through to the chambers. So a lot of the time when there are these astronomical alignments, like there's light that's supposed to come in at this very carefully timed period, you know, like at the solstice or something, and that's not possible with these air shafts. So the shafts, their purpose and meaning, are one of the profound mysteries of the Great Pyramid. We don't know why they're there.
So, let's say we were just in the king's chamber, obsessively inspecting those air shafts. Now, we walk out of that chamber, we descend the grand gallery, and we get to the bottom, to a place where we could either head horizontally to the queen's chamber or down the ascending passage to hook up with the robber's tunnel.
In a totally platonic manner.
Absolutely. This is not some weird three-way we're having.
Maybe it is. It's a wide choose with all the passages in the Great Pyramid.
But wait, Jenny, because there is a third option. Oh my goodness.
Oh, good.
This option is a hole in the ground.
Exciting.
That drops for over 100 feet until it lets out right at the entrance of the subterranean chamber. It's a shortcut going from just about the top of the pyramid all the way to the bottom. And I bet that Jenny wants to climb right into it. Don't you, Jenny?
Oh my God, I do. I do.
So let's go, babe.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. So this is, in fact, perhaps the wildest, most batshit ride you can take in the Great Pyramid. It's wilder than the air shafts. I'm so excited to take you down here. So the well shaft is a very rough passage. This is a rough ride. In places, it's only about 28 inches wide. That's like slightly more than 2 feet. The first 26 feet is a completely vertical drop, although in places there are what seems to be roughly cut footholds and handholds in the walls. Some historians theorize that this was a shortcut passage deliberately cut to allow workers to escape the pyramid after they dropped the granite blocks down the grand gallery and into the ascending chamber, which would have blocked off that exit. So if you think about it, like if the grand gallery in fact was a ramp that people would do with this controlled slide of these blocks down into the ascending chamber, then they're trapped up there, right? The only way to get out is through this well shaft. So as we've said, the first 26 feet is a hair-raising vertical drop down a 28-inch wide hole. From there, the passage descends at a steep slant for another 26 feet until it hits bedrock, and then it drops vertically again. In this place, the passage is lined with bricks, and right where we hit the bedrock that the pyramid rests on, those bricks have been broken through to reveal a small hole behind the wall, barely large enough to stand up in. This is the mysterious grotto.
The grotto is a little room or cave off the well shaft. It was originally walled up behind bricks, but at some point, the brick wall was broken. Researchers think the grotto may have been filled with sand before it was dug out by looters. This is one of the most mysterious and poorly understood sections of the Great Pyramid. It's even badly documented. All we have are some very grainy black and white pictures of workmen squatting in it, which date from maybe the 1920s.
I'm not 100% sure when these photos date to. I think I read somewhere they were from the 1920s. I could be wrong. They could be from the 50s or the 1800s. I think it's probably a little later than the 1800s, but not a lot later. Like, I don't think these are very recent photos.
It could be like the 1901s or whatever. These are old photos.
They look kind of old-fashioned-y, yeah.
Very few people have ever been inside it. Certainly not recently, as far as we're aware, because it's hard and dangerous to get to. That's what she said.
It's the hardest and most dangerous part of the pyramid. We've explored all the erogenous zones. I'm sorry, I made this so dirty. If you don't like wall-to-wall filthy jokes about the pyramid, I don't know what you're listening to or why you're listening to us, because that's what we're giving you.
I want to talk about the grotto and where it's located.
Please tell me where it's located, Jen.
Everyone needs to know about this grotto and its location.
Basically, the pyramid's G-spot.
It truly is. It begins with G. Anyway, the grotto is located just below the surface of the bedrock beneath the pyramid. Some researchers have suggested that this is a Mahdi well or subterranean structure, a sacred well that's older than the pyramid. The Mahdi were a people who lived in this area before the dynastic period of ancient Egypt, and some relics from their time have been found on the Giza Plateau. They were known for building round subterranean wells and chambers, which the grotto resembles, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah, that is one theory that I saw somewhere that I don't know how backed up it is by other researchers. I included it because I just thought it was absolutely fascinating that maybe there's like a little feature inside the pyramid they built around that could have been considered sacred for centuries or millennia before the pyramid was constructed. Maybe that's like the weird beating heart of the sacred pyramid, but I do not know if it's true. So we step out of the grotto and back into the well shaft, which involves a real steep drop. Here, it penetrates the bedrock at a 45-degree angle for 85 feet, and then it gets even steeper before hitting the bottom. At some point, it goes vertical again, where it runs almost horizontally for about 8 feet before opening out right above that door to the subterranean chamber. And then we crawl out, changed. We are not the same.
This is a transformative experience that I'm having right now.
Remember how I said before that there used to be giant granite blocks protecting the king's chamber and that someone had broken them up? Well, they didn't just break them into pieces. They also tossed those pieces all the way down the grand gallery and then dropped them in the well shaft. That's what happened to all those granite blocks blocking the king's chamber. There are broken pieces of those granite blocks piled in the corridor near the subterranean chamber's entrance and stuck in the grotto. They may have even been shoved there by gentlemen scholars when they were exploring the shaft, or they might have just bounced in there. I really don't know. This is all extremely badly documented, and nobody has really investigated this thoroughly, so.
Here's another mysterious cranny. In 2017, researchers under the Scan Pyramids project used muon radiology to scan the whole pyramid looking for hidden chambers, and they found two. One was a rectangular corridor-like chamber behind the gables above the original entrance, just a few feet long. The other was the big void. The big void is a huge open space in the pyramid. It's at least 98 feet long and roughly 28 feet from floor to ceiling. It's directly above the Grand Gallery. There's no entrance. Further scanning studies were scheduled for 2020 and were postponed during the pandemic and thus far have not been picked up again.
We don't know what the big void is. Is it some kind of weird structural anomaly? Was it purposely built for some reason, like to redistribute the weight of the pyramid? Is that where Khufu's real burial chamber is? Is that where they parked the spaceship? We have no idea.
No spaceships.
That's where all the Atlanteans are entombed.
Oh, God.
So now, I've taken you around the outside of the Great Pyramid, as well as on a tour of the inside and all the nooks and the crannies, which is my favorite part. And I've even taken you on a tour of all the weird nooks and the weird crannies that you can't go in as a tourist because I want to get all up in there. I hope you appreciate it. This has been so fun. So before we get to the end, I just want to mention something that I have not brought up yet, and that is the pyramidal alignments. So a lot has been made about the way the pyramids have been aligned and the connection to various stars and constellations, and some of it is more or less legit, some of it's disputed, and some of it is straight up pseudoscience. And I don't want to get into it in too much detail. Like, whole books have been written about this. So I'm not going to do a super deep dive. I just want to do the thumbnail version here.
One thing that's definitely true is that the Great Pyramid, as well as the other pyramids on the Giza Plateau, are precisely aligned to the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. The precise alignment in itself is something of a mystery. We don't know how the ancient builders achieved it.
I mean, they did have the ability to tell, like, where the alignments were, but, like, it's so accurate that I think historians question how they got quite that accurate. And I don't know exactly how accurate it is. Like, is it, like, you can only get that accurate with space lasers? Like, probably not. But it's accurate enough to make people go, why? How?
Other theories have abounded about the pyramid's alignment with various constellations and stars, but bear in mind that the pyramids were built roughly around 4,500 years ago, and the constellations were different then because of shifts in the orientation of the Earth's poles. Any real alignments we'd see would have to work for stars and constellations visible then, not now, and they might be quite different.
So one of the main archaeoastronomy theories is the Orion constellation theory. Sometime in the 1980s, an archaeoastronomer called Robert Bovall suggested that the three Giza pyramids, Khufu's, Khafre's, and Menkaure's, were lined up in an orientation exactly like the three stars in Orion's belt. He wrote about this in a book called The Orion Mystery, published in 1995, which I'm pretty sure that I read back then. And I feel like the 90s were a real, like, banner year for pseudo-history, because this is obviously also the time when the Sphinx water erosion theory was becoming popular.
I think, like, a lot of people in the 90s, they didn't have ready access to the internet the way we do today, so they couldn't debunk any of these theories. And that doesn't just include, like, lay people buying books. It also includes editors and others who just didn't know about this research. So I think it was easier to be a pseudo-historian at this time than in today's day and age when you can be like, but wait a minute, think about this.
That's a really good point, yeah, because I think this was a more credulous time. Like, it was right on the cusp of the internet.
It was, and I think, like, it's really difficult sometimes because, you know, so many of us have now grown up with, like, a phone in our pocket, which is, like, the web in our pocket. Like, I look at my niece, who's 7. And she knows how to work an iPad, knows how to buy things from my mother's Amazon list. Like, she knows everything, and she's known it since she was 2. And she doesn't understand there was a time when you couldn't get this information readily. You'd have to access a scientific journal or all kinds of stuff. And this is also true of editors. And it's also true of people who were publishing these books. They didn't know that some of this research was pseudoscience. So they were platforming it in a way that, like, today we'd be like, that is pseudoscience. Do not.
Anyway, so it is true that Orion's belt was visible in the night sky in Khufu's time, and the stars even had religious significance. The Egyptians believed that they were the resting place for the soul of Osiris, an important god in the pantheon. However, there's no historical indication or mention in ancient Egyptian texts that the pyramids were aligned with Orion's belt in mind.
You have to remember that these pyramids weren't built at the same time. They were each built decades apart, so they couldn't have been built all at once under the same grand Orion alignment plan. But beyond that, the alignments don't actually line up. In 1999, astronomers using a planetarium discovered that the pyramids don't really make the shape of Orion's belt. To get it close, you have to invert one of the pyramids on the end. Also, apparently, Bavol wasn't lining up the pyramids with Orion's belt as it would have looked 4,500 years ago, but as it looks today. Another fail. Some supporters have argued that the pyramid builders weren't lining up the pyramids with Orion's belt 4,500 years ago, but 10,000 years ago. That's right. This theory has close ties to the Sphinx water erosion theory. So this theory is that the pyramids were actually 10,000 years old and weren't tombs at all, weren't even built by the pharaohs, but by aliens or Atlanteans or ancient white people because of racism.
Bavol did a documentary with Graham Hancock in 2000 on BBC Horizon, incidentally. So just, you know, that is another data point. Anyway, so another theory linked with the Orion constellation theory has to do with the air shafts. Some researchers have interpreted these shafts, as we've said, as pointing directly to stars and constellations important to the Egyptian religion. In other words, they were intended as, quote, pathways to heaven for the pharaoh's escaping soul. So this theory began around the 1960s, when some Egyptologists suggested that one of the shafts may have pointed generally in the direction of the North Star 4,500 years ago. Another shaft points in the general direction of Orion's belt, but we've talked about this before. All the shafts run horizontally before slanting up. Some kind of curve and skirt around various anomalies in the pyramid. They don't run straight, and the ones in the queen's chamber were blocked up and don't even reach the outside of the pyramid. So how can the pharaoh's soul escape from one of those shafts? That's a question that no one has answered adequately.
It cannot.
That's the adequate answer. Thank you.
Stellar alignments aren't entirely pseudo-historical. Nabta Playa, the ancient monument from the time of the Green Sahara, was built around 7,500 BC, 3,000 years before the pyramids, and it has astronomical alignments. The Egyptians claim they got their knowledge of such things from the ancestral land of Punt, which could have been roughly where Nabta Playa was. That's one theory, at least. It's clear the Egyptians' knowledge of these things is very old. And it's real.
But also, bear in mind that human brains are programmed to search for patterns. It's a phenomenon called pareidolia. Pretty sure I said that right.
You did. And it's this thing where there's like this, like, just to be like generic, it's like this fallacy that humans have where they search for patterns where they aren't there. And like, if you think about it, if you read your horoscope today, and then you go throughout your day and your horoscope says something sort of vague, you will kind of search for that pattern even if it isn't there. It's wild. That's how our brains work. They look for patterns to make order out of chaos. And what's fascinating is a lot of the ancient Egyptian religion was about making order from the chaos.
I would say that's what a lot of religion is about now.
Well, in general, but particularly, you know.
Yeah. So, in fact, if you look for star alignments on any monument, and we talked about this in our episode about the Nazca lines, given the number of stars and constellations that exist, you have a roughly 30% chance of finding some alignment with something. I'm not claiming that all archaeoastronomy is pseudo-historical. I feel some of it is legit. I do feel pretty confident stating that most of what I come across with regard to the Great Pyramid is. The Orion alignment theory is the most prominent one that I've seen, and that is pseudo-historical. Some of the other stuff is not widely accepted. Take all of it with a grain of salt.
And as this podcast resident sort of like woo-woo girl, I totally agree with Jenny, and I would tell you if I felt a different way. I have seen stars from all different alignments in all different areas of the world. I don't buy this. That said, there are legitimate mysteries to do with the Great Pyramid of Giza. For instance, how did they get the pyramids so precisely lined up to the cardinal directions, the north, south, east, and west?
What were those air shafts for? Question mark. Why? Air shafts. Question.
Why do the air shafts in the Queen's Chamber end about 20 feet before they get to the edge of the pyramid? Why?
What is up with that decorative door high up in the southern air shaft in the Queen's Chamber? Who was going to see that? Why? Question mark.
Was the Grand Gallery indeed a ramp meant to slide down those huge granite blocks for the workers? Or maybe not?
Who dug out the robber's tunnel and the tunnel around the granite blocks that protected the King's Chamber? Was it the same person? Was it tomb robbers?
Yes, 100%. What was up with the grotto? Is it in fact an ancient sacred well, older than the pyramid, preserved forever underneath the pyramid? Who knows?
Is it haunted by ghosts older than the pyramid?
Yes, 100%.
The well shaft, why? The great void, what, why? What's in there? I need to know. So those are some of the mysteries we've come across so far. But there's another mystery, perhaps greater than any of these. How was the Great Pyramid built? That is a mystery. There are theories, but nobody knows for sure. And in our next installment, we are going to explore this mystery in all of its thoroughness. Get ready.
Hot.
Do me, Duke. In Lady Arbuthnot's chamber.
So that's it for this week. Join us next week for part two of our epic, many-hour deep dive into the Great Pyramid.
And in the meantime, you can find us on Threads, Facebook, Instagram, at Ancient History Fangirls, should you want to continue talking to us, which I can't imagine why you would.
I'm so sorry. I apologize. It's Jen. I'm apologizing.
You can join our Patreon at patreon.com/ancienthistoryfangirl. I'm sure you want to do that after all of this. I actually have some awesome bonus pyramid content that I want to do. I may be getting a little bit overzealous and overambitious, but what I would love to do is an episode about all the bad pyramids that the ancient Egyptians messed up building before they built the Great Pyramid, and also how to rob a pyramid, how to go about that. Because I love to get a little bit scoundrelly in the Patreon.
And I love it when she gets scoundrelly and I can just totally like tease her a little bit, but also really revel in the research she's done and just be here for it. And I know so many of you out there also feel the same. Now listen, I'm drunk. It's midnight. We love you. Thank you so much for listening to us. We're ready to go to bed. Thank you.
Thanks, Drunk Jen. So anyway, I guess we're done. We don't have any Patreon members to thank. I can't imagine why. Thank you all so much for listening. Dad, I really hope you've stopped at this point. We will see you next week.
God, Jenny.